XM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and well, almost the bottom of the hour. We'll get Tony in here and get a little action. I think I hear Tony in the background already. Tony.
Hey, Steve, how you doing? I've been listening this morning, and I'm thinking, being a jockey and the worst handicapping jockey in the world, what could I possibly add to Sam Houston and the handicapping that you just did? Other than Asmussen and Elliot, what a good combination. And I
you
know
like
one
that.
Thing about it. Elliot, top rider. He was a top rider wherever he's going. He doesn't have to prove himself anymore. And one of the best moves he ever made was, you know, he spent a lot of time at Parks, Philadelphia Park and Parks Racetrack. And then leaving only confirms what I'm saying, because he's had a lot of success throughout the country. And, you know, of course, a Derby and Preakness winner that he is with Smarty Jones. Just a top rider. You know, competitive, and, you know, not just being a top rider, because he probably is a lot better handicapper than me, but he's a good athlete. You know, he really took his weight and his athleticism seriously. So I can't endorse any more than that, the rider that he is. And then, of course, he's riding for Asmussen. What else can you ask for other than, well, I was on the radio last night with Bob Baffert. Maybe if you had to make a switch in business, you either want to ride for Asmussen or Baffert, wherever you're at. You know, you can't do any better than that. You know, and the one thing that I was really impressed with when it comes to the few times I've met Bob Baffert, he's so approachable, you know. What a guy. You can talk to him about his horses. When I was at the Hall of Fame Museum in Saratoga in 2019, I had a one-on-one with him, and I had my little boy there and Kylie. And, you know, it was no problem going up and saying, hey, my son and Kylie want a picture with you. Any problem with that? And he says, oh, of course not. I'll get my driver to take their picture on your phones right now. So guys like that. Well, they're really great for the business. You know, Asmussen and Baffert, these guys that are so easy to talk to and approachable. But one thing about it, the business needs more and has a lot of people like that in it. And you come into that category, Steve, a guy that really tells people what the business is all about. And, you know, I've noticed you're pretty approachable, too. I have no problem talking to you.
No, why wouldn't I? Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't I be? I'm easily easily approached. That's for sure. I hear you. I love it. Tony, I got to ask you. I think I've brought her up with you before, but this morning when I was putting together the Saturday PPs and you know, all the stakes they drew yesterday, the What a Summer is going to go on Saturday at Laurel, and it popped in my head immediately that you got a turn on What a Summer.
Yeah, that's a story in itself. And What a Summer started out in Maryland, I believe, and
with Buddy Delp.
Buddy Delp initially trained her. In 77 that I went to New York? I think Garden State burned down. She was racing in that air, right? The 77?
Yeah, late 70. Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, so I went to New York because Garden State burned down in April, and I went to Aqueduct, and I said, well, let me spend there's no racing in Jersey. because of the burning down of Garden State. And for whatever reason, I went to New York. I guess Philadelphia Park or Parks was a race, and I don't know. I forget the whole story. But anyway, I was up there and rode a few races. And I think the one race that I rode was on a horse called Una Duel for Danny Lopez, and the horse won, and I'm walking back. And it was Leroy Jolly who was training What a Summer then. And he says, Tony, he says, go tell the clerk of scales to put you on my horse in the stake. I says, man, I didn't even know who it was. Yeah, okay, I'll do it right now. I went back to the jock's room, and the clerk of scales, I walked right up to him. It was a few races later, the stake. I said, put me on the horse, Leroy's horse, in the stake. He just told me to ride the horse. He says, what do you mean? I says, he just walked back with me from this last race and told me the name on the horse. Well, I'm not going to have it announced till Leroy calls. I don't know that he told you to do that, but when he calls, I'll put you on the horse. So some time went by, and, of course, Leroy called and said he didn't hear the announcement. He says, put back on my horse. And the clerk says, yeah, he really wants you on that horse in the handicap. I think it was a handicap.
It was. I told you. I just looked it up. Yep.
Yeah. I says, well, that's what I told you. And he says, well, I can't take your word for it. I mean, I got to hear it from the trainer. Says, all right, whatever, no problem. I'm just a new kid in town. So anyway, I rode the horse, and she just won for fun. You know, it wasn't even anything you had to do except sit on her and stay on her from the start to the finish. The only way you could have got her beat is if you fell off of her. And, of course, I didn't do that. But it was really interesting because, you know, it just shows in 77 I wasn't a known product, and I went to New York because of other reasons, you know, hadn't ridden up there since I had the bug. In fact, you know what? I did ride up there when I had the bug because Charlie Coco had leased my contract to Gil Prentice. And we were in Maryland. When my lease was up with Gil Prentice and Garden State hadn't opened yet, Charlie went to New York for Aqueduct. And I rode the Aqueduct part of the meet till Garden State opened. It was the earliest Aqueduct ever opened, March 1st. You know, and I left Maryland and went to Aqueduct. And, you know, I was just reminiscing about this morning because there was another bug rider up there. I still had the bug. It was, I guess, 71, winter of 71. And there was another bug rider up there, and I just heard something this morning that was kind of heartbreaking. Jamie Arellano and I had the bug around the same time. And Jamie was a New York known, and I was just a kid coming to New York because of my boss wanted some place to run some horses before Garden State opened in April. And first horse I rode up there was a Roman, and it put me back in with my boss because he was mad at me at the time, and he was going to set me down. And he said, I'll name you on this horse, but you're going to be watching the races for a while for some reasons he had because he was mad at me. Well, was a Roman won. And of course, that made everything all right. He stopped being mad at me. And the only reason he was mad at me is Gil Prentice wouldn't let me go to Dover one night to ride a horse for Charlie. And I went down there, and the clerk of scales says, Charlie doesn't have your contract. He leased you to Gil Prentice. Gil Prentice called and said, you can't ride the horse tonight. Go back home. And I did.
Wow.
And Charlie got mad. Charlie got mad because I finished out riding my contract lease with Gil Prentice instead of watching the races for a few months. So, you know, it's tough being a jockey and under contract. But Charlie Coco was really good to me, and he put me back in his good graces by putting me on Was Roman. And I was leading bug rider at the time, and I think like second or whatever, second leading rider or leading rider Aqueduct until we left and went to Garden State. But my heart goes out to Jamie Arellano. I heard that he succumbed to his passing for whatever reason. And you know, it's a tough business, and some of us survive it, and I guess some of us don't.
Well, you tell that story about What a Summer, and that was that 77. She was champion sprinter that year.
Yeah, and the year before, I think what put me in with that horse is Leroy probably saw me ride a champion sprinter from, I guess it was 76, was My Juliet.
Right.
And I went to New York, and what really clinched the Eclipse Award for My Juliet was the Vosburgh, when she beat Bold Forbes in the Vosburgh. And that was what clinched her achieving the Eclipse Award for that year. And I'll never forget it, because I always laugh. Every once in a while, I see Cordero. In fact, I saw him, I think it was last year. Yeah, last year when they inducted My Juliet into the National Horse Racing Hall of Fame at Saratoga. And he claimed foul against me. And it's a little known fact. He claimed foul against me. And he rode a horse called, was it It's Freezing? I forget who. No, wasn't it? I forget who he claimed foul on me. He was the one. Oh, and they took him down and placed him third because he bothered somebody leaving the gate. That was a race. I'm trying to think who he rode. But anyway, it kind of tickled me because here I won the race. He claimed foul and they took him down. So even the best miscalculate things at times and always laugh. I even mentioned it to him when I saw him that time. Man, that you claimed foul. They left me up. They took you down. He forgets that story. He forgets it.
Well, and that, you know, frankly, that's a funny aside because it's probably far from the only case where when the stewards go to look at the tape and they see something that they otherwise might have let go. And
yeah,
there
was no inquiry.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So I wouldn't have liked. I would have liked to have heard that conversation between Angel and whoever he was riding for. You had to open your mouth.
It was one of those things where you leave the gate and you go down the backside, and of course, going in the backside, I'm on a horse that I'm going to protect the rail but not want to be on the rail. And he came up to where I seen him well before he got up in there and made him come out of there. You know, he saw, I knew he was there, so he wasn't going to keep going forward on the inside. And he came around me. And, of course, coming around sometimes, you don't want to be on the inside, but you don't want somebody to have an easy trip coming around you. So you kind of head them out at certain points of the turn. And then you drop back over at the quarter pole as you straighten up, and you go on about your business. But something that he's probably done a million times.
Oh, God.
You know? You know, it's hurting, but within the rules. Hurting and doing it at the right time where it's not an infraction, you know. And of course, that's race riding, and that's aggressiveness of a race rider shows at times. But it was funny because he got perturbed and claimed foul, but he forgot when he left the gate, he made a left turn or did something to somebody leaving the gate. It was a right or a left, and sawed somebody off, and they took him down for leaving the gate. You know, when it comes to that hurting, I'll never forget. Mike Smith came to town a few years ago, and I came back up to the jocks room to do something, and he's sitting there telling a story to a bunch of the kids, and he sees me walking in the back door. He says, "Hey, Tone," he says, "I was just telling these kids, and they're laughing about the Pennsylvania Derby," because it was a Derby day. He says, "When you and I rode against each other," he says, "what you did to me is what I'm used to doing to people." And he rode Formal Gold, and I rode Devil's Honor and won the race. And he rode Formal Gold and finished second. And he was cracking up, and I says, "Man, Mike, you're making me into a big man to these kids." He says, "Well, I just wanted to let you know what you did to me, I do every day to people, too." And we laughed about it, and the kids all laughed about it. But race riding, you know, it's a competitive, interesting thing that you do out there as a jockey. And there are ways to do things that make you competitive and aggressive, but still within the rules of racing, where it's clean and you're not crossing the line, and you do things in the fair spirit of competition, because everybody loves to win. It's one of the biggest thrills I've had in my life is winning races.
Well, I think Steve Askin just texted me. He says, and Steve, I'm not sure if Tony means if he means the Bold Forbes occasion in the Vosburgh, I think he's, you're talking about a different race versus versus Angel.
No, it wasn't the Vosburgh because they, because Bold Forbes finished second, and that's where they
right.
asked him second.
This is a different
this is a different
occasion versus versus Angel.
I can't remember exactly what race it was, but I do remember the claim of foul, and it just cracks me up when I think about it, you know, and I'm sure it's one of those things he thinks about and wasn't a significant part of his career. But, you know, there are things that make have significance to different people in their career. And, of course, anything that's connected to Angel is a happening because he was absolutely unbelievable and one of the most charismatic riders there was, and not just charismatic, aggressive. I mean, what was it, Codex and the Preakness? That was a standout performance of his. You know, things like that, that, you know, at times you cross the line and at times you don't. But he's an icon in the sport. I mean, he's
no doubt.
He was unbelievable. Angel.
Well, and actually, right. Tony, Steve says that Bold Forbes was disqualified from second to third in the Vaz.
Well, then that's what it was.
Okay.
He was disqualified in the when you threw
it was
the
Vosburgh.
Yeah, it was the Vosburgh. You know what? I just found the chart.
There you go.
Bold Forbes, DQ.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve. I guess we're gonna trust Steve Faskin's memory just a tad better, a little bit more than yours.
Okay, Juliet sprinted. Here's a sprinted right to the front, and that's how the chart goes. He bothered. It's freezing leaving the gate. That's what it was.
There you go. You mentioned it's freezing. Good for you. You're right. You were right.
It's freezing is who he bothered, and they took him down and placed him. But the chart shows him just second and DQ. I just found the chart. And
there
you know
you go.
Why I found the chart? Because somebody made me a picture of my Juliet and put the Vosburgh chart on the picture with a small set of colors. So I just found the chart.
Since we got into this with Angel too, I just pulled out What a Summer and her record out of Champions, and she really had a spectacular career, 18 for 31. And Tony, you were in good company riding her. Listen to the other riders who had turns on What a Summer. Chris McCarron rode her for her first eight or nine, including her Black Eyed Susan win, and a win in the Anne Arundel. Then Eddie Maple rode her in the Distaff before you did in the Distaff at Aqueduct, the great Philly sprint race. Then you rode her in that handicap. Eddie Maple had her in the Regret or in the Gray Flight. Craig Perrett rode her in the Regret. Then Shoemaker rode her to a win in the Silver Spoon out in Hollywood. Jacinto had her for five starts, including wins in the Fall Highweight and the Masquette. She wasn't as good stretching out. She won races going longer, but she was better sprinting. Then Mickey Solomon had her for some starts, including an allowance win. Then Angel had her and alternated. She went out and won another Silver Spoon at Hollywood with Shoemaker. And then Jeff Fell rode her last three starts, which included a second to Dr. Patches in the Vosburgh. She won the first flight. And then Topsider beat her in neck in the Sport page. This is some tremendous career. And this horse is not, this is like the new My Juliet, not getting enough credit for, what she accomplished in her career.
Absolutely. I mean, she's a tremendous competitor. I was supposed to ride her one more time on the next start of her life. I mean, not next start, but the next start after I rode her. At Pimlico, and she was entered. And I was all set to go up there, and she scratched. And I forget the total, the exact reason why, but he decided not to run her, and he scratched her. She was in, I believe it was Pimlico. And it was a few weeks after I had ridden her. So I was going to get another opportunity on her, but I didn't realize all the riders you just named. I mean, world-class riders.
Holy cow, it's a list.
On the charts with those world-class riders, geez, I didn't know. I was, they actually elevated me just being named on a horse like that. But she was kind of a lot like my Juliet, you know. She, like my Juliet, you know, ran, geez, let me think, it was around, she won a bunch of races, and she would go long, but she was a better sprinter than distance horse, but she did win races again.
Sure.
My Juliet had 36 starts, 24 wins, 4 seconds, and 2 thirds. And, you know, when you look at this and you think of the races that she won in, I'm looking at a try right now, and a thing, a lifetime thing. I'm looking at the Racing Hall of Fame plaque that they gave me on my Juliet. $548,859. She'd have earned millions if
yeah.
it was not 77. 74 to 77 is when she ran. But 36 and 24, 36 starts, 24 wins. That's an unbelievable accomplishment. And,
no
and
doubt.
What a summer is right there with us. I mean, really. And they ran in the same air, really.
Steve Haskins going to join us. And as it happens that this conversation comes up, I've been added to the Hall of Fame the nomination process, and we just got the email this week about the preliminary stuff about, you know, picking horses to forward for consideration. And I just asked Steve by email, has What a Summer ever been considered? And you know, she won 2 fall high weights. She faced the boys 5 times. She got beat by some of the top horses of her era. And Steve, you know, Dainty Dotsy beat her, Laurie. I mean, she only got beat by some of the best horses of her era, and she deserves some Hall of Fame consideration, no?
Well, first off, don't bury the lead. I didn't know you were on the committee. Welcome.
Why, thank you.
Well, it'll be interesting.
Before you get Steve.
Glad to have you aboard.
Thanks.
We'll
go ahead, Tony.
We get into some heavy duty opinions on there. So
nice,
Tony. To answer your question, What a Summer was probably eligible to the Hall of Fame a long time ago.
Yeah,
but
she retired in 78.
I would say, you know, the thing is, for some reason the committee they don't get too high on the sprinters or the filly sprinters or anything. I know a horse like Kona Gold has been trying to get in forever. Who's, you know, a horse has been in the Breeders' Cup Sprint 5 times. He finished first, second, third, and fourth in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. I don't know if he's ever even made the ballot, but I mean, he's always been
of course
up
he
the
has.
Conversation.
No, he just the last couple of years.
So maybe made the ballot, but people, you know, people just aren't, you know, they frown upon voting for sprinters for some reason. But I mean, she, you know, listen, there's been a lot of great filly sprinters, and she's right up there with the best of them. I mean, she had an amazing career.
I went through the fields for everybody earlier this morning, and I knew Tony was going to be on, and it popped in my head that I knew Tony had ridden her for, you know, for Leroy, and Milt Pollinger, we've talked about Milt Pollinger, you know, who bred her, and then What a Summer ended up with the Firestones, right? After Pollinger died, I think.
Yeah.
Most
of her career was with was for the Firestones. But the thing is, you know, before they went to the Firestones, she wasn't a sprinter. I think she won like the Black Eyed Susan.
She did.
She was running in distance race, 2-turn races, in Maryland until the Firestones got her. I think Buddy
and Leroy tried her. Well, he tried her, and Leroy did try her long. He even tried her on the grass, and she ran okay in the Suwannee River. She got beat a neck by Lenz Determined in the 78 Suwannee.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, she ran a hell of a race to Cumulati Laurie. Cumulati Laurie, by the way, owned racing that fall. I mean, she won everything that year, and she would have gotten the championship that year, except that they gave it to Al Mims, who had won the Alabama and the coaching club. But in the fall of the year, it was totally dominated by Cumulati Laurie. I mean, she won everything. She won the Beltane, the Spinster, the Gazelle. I mean, everything you could think of, she won. Yeah, she was terrific. And what if Summer almost beat her in the Beltane?
Well, you also, and I know this is a horse, Tony, we've talked about with you, and I know you had you were going to bring something up with Steve, but Dainty Dotsie as well during that.
Oh, God, did I love her.
And I rode her, her last start of her, one of the last starts of her career, and I was working for J.R. Cowden at the time. And she was, they all kind of were kind of alike. Dainty Dotsie, My Juliet, What a Summer. They were intelligent horses. They were world class sprinters, but they would, under the right conditions, go long. You could get them to relax. Now, I rode What a Summer, you know, and only the once. But she had the intelligence of a horse that would relax if you wanted her to go further. My Juliet would relax, and so would Dainty Dotsie. In fact, when I rode her, I think it might have been at Penn National on the grass corn.
It was. I just pulled it up. You won a conditional allowance by 4 lengths at 1-5 at Penn National.
Steve, excuse me. If you have her record there, go to the beginning of her career. I think she won like 15 of her first 16 starts. It was like absurd.
Yeah, she did.
Billy Phelps rode her when she first started Dainty Dotsie.
Yep.
J.R. trained her, I believe he owned her. You know, just a little thing that brought back memory with What a Summer. I'll never forget the day that I wrote her. Two or three days after I wrote her, I got a letter from Bertram Firestone thanking me for picking up What a Summer, and they noticed. And I'm thinking, what, are you kidding me? I'd have cut my right arm off the rider. He sent me a thank you letter, and I've got it. I saved that kind of stuff. But what a class act, you know, to thank a jockey for riding a winner under short notice, and you think that was the whole jocks room full of jocks that would have begged a rider.
I got to tell you, it's amazing that this came up, and the timing, Steve, considering the Hall of Fame portion of the conversation. Dainty Dotsie won 20 of 24 starts.
Yeah. I mean, she started her career absurd. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but like I said, I think it was like 15 of her first. I think she had 1 second. She was like 15 wins, 1 second in the first 16 starts, or something to that effect. I mean, you can count them up.
She was 16. 16 for 17, and the only loss was in the Ashland.
Right. Yeah. It was unbelievable. 16 out of her first 17. Can you imagine if she was running today? She'd be a household name. Nobody remembers her.
Just what we were saying about these horses of that era. You know, there was another horse running at that era, but he is in the Hall of Fame, I believe, that I had the opportunity of riding his last start. And if you look him up, it was a horse called Gallant Bob.
Oh, God. Well, of course. Everybody knows him.
Gallant Bob, and I rode him. It's funny, I rode Dainty Dotsie her last start one time. I rode What a Summer, not her last start, but one time. I rode Gallant Bob, I believe it was his last win before he was retired. And in that same era, I was lucky enough to get on horses like Candy Eclair, who was an Eclipse Award winner.
Wow, you're talking heavy-duty sprinters there. I mean, she was an Eclipse Award winner. I think she actually was the co-sprinter that year.
Yeah, it's in the air. It's in the
That's right. I think that's right. 2 year old, not sprinter.
Co-champion, I think.
Two year old champion.
Yeah.
Well, I know she was a co-champion with somebody. And the thing is, at least Gallant Bob's got a pretty prestigious stakes named after him at Parks.
Sure does. Yeah. 3 year olds.
My Juliet. And My Juliet does too. But, you know, some nice horses trained at Parks. Gallon Bob, J.D. Marquette trained Gallon Bob. What a Summer trained in New York and Maryland. But then Danny Dotsie, J.R. Cowden trained J.R. Cowden trained Danny Dotsie. Candy Eclair was raised and trained at by Alan. Alan. Oh, what the heck's his last name? You know, Alan King.
Alan King. Paxton, I was going
to say. Yeah, Miss Paxton bred her, and she was an Eclipse Award winner training at Philadelphia Park Keystone, I guess it was Keystone at the time. But a lot of good horses came through that stable gate at Keystone, and I was lucky enough to be doing just well enough to have my name as one of the picks to ride those kind of horses. Lucky guy. I was in the right place at the right time.
Hey, you know,
well, Tony, you remember the year, you go back, you remember the years when Maryland was a very, very important circuit in the winter because there was no New York racing. And all the good horses went there to run into John B. Campbell and the Barbara Fritchie and a lot of big horses. Hoist the Flag made his first start in Maryland in an allowance race in Bowie, won by 15 lengths.
Great winter racetrack, Bowie was. And
yeah.
Would be running through the winter. And then the only time, and that's when I got leased out because Jersey wasn't running. Maryland was running. New York wasn't running. So my boss, who had a farm in Jersey, leased me out to Gil Prentice, who was in New York but went to Maryland to race during the Bowie meet. And he leased my contract to him. And I went to Bowie with Gil Prentice until New York opened, and New York didn't open that year until March 1st. That was the earliest ever opening. I just talked about that. And then I went and met my contract employer back in New York, who was a Jersey farm owner. But
those Maryland hard boot trainers were tough. They know they every winter, you know, they were there at Bowie and Laurel and later on Pimlico. But during the winter, those in Bowie, Those were good, tough horsemen. A lot of great horsemen. Frank Whiteley came up in that circuit running in the small tracks in Charlestown and out in West Virginia and Maryland and stuff. But you had to be tough on that circuit. They were good, good horsemen. And people don't recognize it. If anybody wants to go back, go on Google and go back and look at the winners of the John B. Campbell. You'll see, you'll be surprised the names of the horses that won that race, the great horses that ran in there. Because that, if you didn't go down to Florida, that was the way to run because there was no New York racing. So you went to the Campbell, and there was always a top field of horses in there.
That's the only reason I won the Campbell, because there was no racing in this area, and I wound up going to Maryland. I think Keystone went on strike or whatever it was, so there wasn't any racing there. And I wound up riding a horse called Majesty's World.
I remember him. He was a good horse.
Paid $70, and I'll never forget when I came back. As one of the few times I beat Passmore and Nose, and I think he rode either Go Roger, 38 paces. I forget who he rode. But anyway, Leatherberry came running out to the winner's circle. He thought he won the race, and I came back to the winner's circle, and they put my number up, and Leatherberry dropped his head and walked back to the grandstand, and I won the race on Majesty's World.
Yeah, I remember him.
I think $70. And that was one of the horses I had ridden for Frank Alexander when they had a double card at Meadowlands. They ran two cards at Meadowlands one time. I think it was either New Year's Day or whatever it was. And they ran a day and a night card, and I won four on the day and night card. And that was Majesty's World was one of the four. That's the only reason I wound up on Merlin.
Those jockeys were tough there, too. Go back also and look and see how many Eclipse champion apprentices came from Maryland. I mean, all the great apprentice jockeys came from Maryland back then.
Yep, there was a lot of them. I'll never forget the one day they canceled races at Bowie, and then Vince Pacali and I were kind of living together just before he got married. And we left Bowie that day because they canceled the races. He's going to get married the next day at Charlestown. So we left Bowie racetrack that morning when they canceled. We got halfway up the road. It was in a blizzard. That's how bad it was, a blizzard. We spent 24 hours on the road in a car and ran out of gas for 12 of the 24 hours.
This is the greatest.
12 of the 24 hours, no gas. Lucky we all threw our laundry, him and I threw our laundry and all the booze for the wedding in the back seat of the car. Now we're soaking wet from pushing out because there's trucks that are stranded. Everybody's stranded. I guess it was 81 or 78, I don't know. 24 hours. Ran out of gas for 12 hours. Him and I are huddled together with all our dirty laundry on, hugging each other, trying to stay warm. And finally the half tracks came in like 10 o'clock the next morning. And the half tracks came in and we got in the half tracks and they took us to the firehouse where we got warm. We like to freeze to death. It's the scariest feeling in the world that you're freezing cold. And there's no place to go and get warm. I'll never forget it. And Jimbo and I, Vince Vercalli, and we missed his wedding. He got married a day later. But we were a day late to the wedding. And there was no cell phones in the 70s. It wasn't like we could call and say we're stuck on the road. They didn't know what happened. We got to the firehouse and we made contact with him. And then we rescheduled the wedding for the next day. And I was best man at Vince Vercalli Jr.'s wedding at Charlestown after 24 hours stuck in a car, freezing half to death.
Such a great story.
You don't hear stories like that anymore. I mean, I tell you, those old-time jockeys, yourself included, were tough, tough jockeys. You know what they had to go through back then. You remember, you want to talk about a tough jockey, too, by the way. You remember Ray Broussard, right?
Oh, for sure, Ray.
Ray Broussard had a hot tub in his, a steam box in his house built in. And he was riding in the stakes the next day. Yeah. And he had gone fishing, and he had come back, and he had to ride a stake, and he had to make the, but he had to make the weight, and he had to actually lose weight, so he went into his steam box when he got home, and he lost electricity, so he had no steam, he had no steam box, he had no weight, and he was overweight at the time, so he put on his a sweatsuit, and he went out in his car, and he put the heat on full blast, and he sat in his car all night until he lost like the 2 pounds or so that he had to lose to make that race.
Yeah, I rode a lot with Ray, and he was in my own. That's no lie. That's a true story. Know the story. And, that's the way guys did it. They reduced Ray, and there's other riders at that time. In fact, even Jimbo Vercalli, and for me for a little while, but I wasn't heavy. The weights were lighter then, of course. But some of these riders were the biggest heavers that you ever want to meet. There was Ronnie Baranis, Ray Broussard, guys like that. You talk about guys that ate and heaved, and not just once or twice at dinner time. That was part of the activity of the day, was to eat and heave, because they reduced in the box, right? You might have pulled 3, 4, 5 pounds in the box. You got out of the box, you're thirsty as can be. And it isn't so much the hunger, but it's the thirst. So what you did, you ate up and you drank like all you could fit. Your stomach would stick out farther than your chest when you got done. And then you went and heaved. And you made sure that you didn't leave that fluid in your stomach too long. And you made sure you had other things in your stomach to absorb the fluid. But it got you through the psychological part of being not so much hungry, but being terribly thirsty after pulling 3, 4, 5 pounds in the box. I can remember walking into the jock's room and having to do 110 on the horse, and I weighed like 13. So of course to do 10, you got to pull 3 pounds just to get down to 10, and 3.5 pounds to get you down to 7.5, 8. Did it. Did 10, pulled 6 pounds, did 10.
But
that was the way jockeys did it then. It was nothing to sit in the box with Broussard, and he'd have a big bucket of ice with all his drinks in it. And while he was sweating, he was drinking. And then he was running out to the heaving bowl, because they had special bowls just to heave in. In the bathroom.
Unbelievable.
It was called the heaving bowl. It was the end stall, and it was a big bowl, and it had a flusher, and you could stand over it, and you couldn't hit the floor with the heave because the bowl was so big. And you heaved, you drank, you went back in the box, you pulled 2, 3 more pounds because you still had to like 5 or 6 pounds to pull, so you pulled 2 or 3 more, and out of the get and over in order to get over the psychological part of it, you drank while you're pulling weight, and then you heaved before your body absorbed it. I mean, is it crazy or is it crazy? But I'm so glad they
raised unbelievable.
The in some regard, I'm glad they raised the weights. But all of that does, to some degree, is let bigger people become jockeys.
I did a feature on Ray Broussard for the Louisiana Horse years ago, and he was telling me how, I mean, it was like a natural order of things. I mean, he would eat and then heave every single time. I mean, I don't know how anybody could live like that.
That's very bad for you.
Did it? Yeah. You know what, though? I survived it. Vince Bracali taught me how to heave when we lived together. You know, but he was a guy that was bigger than me, and we both wrestled our way through high school. The only reason we graduated high school is because both of us wrestled in different. He was West Virginia state champ. You know, I was runner-up in Jersey. You know, eating and heaving was just a way of avoiding having to be on strict diets, and it was a way to take care of the psychological part of dieting and not dieting. You know, you ate, you heaved, you ate, you heaved, you sweat, you drank, you ate, you heaved, you sweat, you drank, you ate, you heaved, and it would go on throughout the day. It was unbelievable. And you know, when you read about some of these guys that don't live to be ripe old age. I'm sure the eating and the heaving and that lifestyle of reducing took its toll on many of
no doubt.
Riders.
No doubt.
Yeah.
You know, Tony, there's a name, you know, since you brought up Gallant Bob, I've got to throw a couple of names at you because there's a couple in here that I maybe have seen in passing, you know, beside, you know, you and Brumfield. There's Galatano.
He rode him for the biggest part of his career and had the most success on. I think he won about 13 races on Gallant Bob. I think. I'm not positive.
How about Billy Ashebrenner?
Billy Ashebrenner.
Yeah.
You know what? Man. Names that don't really register.
Billy, Ashebrenner, and John Featherolf.
Yeah, were these guys that rode him in the beginning of his career?
No, this is a Keystone and Bowie and Aqueduct at Lake City.
I think Galatano rode him a lot.
Galatano, we mentioned.
Yeah, I know, but I think he was his regular rider for a long time early on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
J.D. Marquette trained him, and he was Gallant Bob's main rider for, I think 13, 14 of his wins, I think. How many wins did Gallant Bob have, career wins?
21. 21 of 69.
Yeah, and I think Galatano won the biggest part of them. I don't know the exact number. And I know I did ride him his last win, right?
Let me see. Good question. The last time you rode him was he was fifth at Keystone.
I rode him in
March of 78, you went off favored in an allowance, and yeah, you did. You did ride him his last win.
Yeah, yep. I thought it was.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't Gallant Bob, like later in his career, like running a steeplechase race?
He did. I can see that he was with Tom Walsh, trained him a little bit.
Yeah.
And so did Danny Smithwick. So did Smithwick at the end.
You don't see that too. You don't see champion sprinters running and going in steeplechases. But what people don't realize is that the greatest steeplechasers, especially like in Europe, the Grand National winners, they were all sprinters. They're not distance horses. They're sprinters.
Jeez, I didn't even realize that. You know, but you know, sprinters. There are a group of sprinters, like I was mentioning earlier. You know, like Danny Dotsie, What a Summer, My Juliet, and Gallant Bob being one of them. They were quick, but they were intelligent enough to put to sleep in the early stages of the race. And that's why at times they would go long. They were definitely better sprinters than distance horses, but because of their mental ability that you could take advantage of, you could leave the gate aggressively, drop your hands, and just relax and not fight them. You not put that bit strongly into their mouth. You didn't do that. You could just lightly touch their mouth and bring them back to you, and they would prick their ears and they would relax. If you got them to relax in the early stages, when especially if they had already had a forward position, you could get them to run as far as they could ever possibly believe they could run, because they were relaxed and anxiety wasn't eating them up. You know, most good athletes, their biggest opponent isn't always just their competition. It's anxiety, their self-competition, and what they do to themselves to waste and not utilize energy efficiently and effectively in a human athlete. Well, in an animal athlete, it's what you can do to utilize their ability efficiently and effectively, and you can stretch them out. And that's the only reason some of these sprinters stretched out, because they were intelligent individuals that would relax in the early stages.
Yep. Love it.
Well, there was an American. I'm drawing a blank with my my old age. I'm drawing a blank. But there was an American horse. I'm not sure if it was Ben Nevis or somebody before him. But there was an American horse that won the Grand National. And there's only been like one or two. He won the Grand National. He started off his career running in 4 furlong races at Shenandoah Downs. And he wound up winning the English Grand National.
Shenandoah.
So, Red Rum, who may have been the greatest steeplechaser of all time, started off as he was a sprinter. I mean, that's a misconception that people have about horses that are winning steeplechases, especially like a Grand National, where, you know, you're going 4.5 miles or so. But it's the sprinters that do well. It's maybe because the way they're built or whatever. But, you know, you do need some speed at some point. But it's a misnomer when you think that these are all, you know, all, you know, distance horses and routers and stuff. But they're not.
Sure.
I rode one horse that was a router, and I think they took him and they steeplechased him. And, in fact, it was the horse that had won the Pennsylvania Derby on, if I believe. And he was a router. But I don't think he really did anything when they steeplechased him. And here was a router, Devil's Honor, when they retired him from Thoroughbred Racing, went to, to steeplechase, jump racing, and didn't do a whole lot. But so... that kind of says right along with what you're saying, Steve. You know, sometimes the sprinters that have some early speed can go long as they have the mental ability to do so.
Well, I believe that the Haskell, well, back when it was the Monmouth Invitational, the first running of that race ever, I think, was run by a former steeplechase horse.
Huh. I wonder who trained that one.
I don't know. I'm just trying to think of. I might have been Big Rock Candy. I think it was. I think if that was his name.
Yeah, there was a Big Rock Candy, and I think Lenny Loveridge trained Big Rock Candy, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was him, but it was. It was the first running ever of that race. No, it wasn't Big Rock Candy. What was that horse's name? It was like 17 hands. It's a big monster horse, and he was a steeplechaser. And they inaugurated this race at Monmouth. Oh, Balustrade. That was his name, Balustrade.
Yeah.
And he was a steeplechaser. And they ran him in this new race, the Monmouth Invitational. And he won. He paid a big price.
It's amazing what horses can do, you know, when it comes to sprinting and going long. Of course, the way they're trained plays into it so much. But a lot of it is, you know, what their mental ability has to match their physical ability. And that does make a big difference with horses. I've ridden horses that really have ability, but you get them out there in the afternoon and their anxiety and their eats them up and their nerves eat them up. And you think you're doing the right thing by throwing them down and sinking the bit in the mouth, and all you're doing is taking away from their overall performance, because when you fight a horse with the bit in their mouth for so long, it's dynamic tension. All it does, it's like doing isometric exercises. You know, you're utilizing their muscles and you're depleting them, their muscles and their respiratory system, because you're fighting them. When horses relax, it's amazing what they can do and how far they can run.
Tony, this was tremendous,
yeah.
And we'd go and go, but let me pull up and get some stuff in with Steve for the weekend ahead, including the LeCompte, and we will talk to you next week.
Okay, just one more thing. I just want to say this real quick. thank you so much, Steve, for all you did to help me, to help or to actually get my Juliet in.
Yeah.
That was a big moment in my life. And I look at her pictures that I have of her, and tears come to my eyes sometimes. But every time I see her picture, I think of you. Thank you so much, Steve Haskin, for helping getting her in.
It was well deserved, and it was really great when she finally got in. I mean, it took several years, but got it done.
Well, thank you, and I'm choking up just thinking about what you did. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. You guys take care. Keep up the good work. Love y'all. Bye.
See you, Tony.
That was great, Tony. I when you texting me, Steve, I said to Casey, get Haskin in here, because I knew that it would spark up nicely. So that was great.
It's freezing, and I remember the race well. I remember when with Cordero Clint Fallon got taken down coming out of the gate. I remember it was just freezing in the Vosburgh. So I figured he didn't remember which race it was. So I had to chime in.
I love it. Well, and actually, you sparked a whole bunch of ideas for me, including, as mentioned, the suggestions to put forth for consideration of the nominating committee process with the Hall. And I mean that career is absolutely neighboring what a Summers on Hall of Fame. I mean, two fall highweights counts for a lot, you would think.
Well, not only that, but people have to remember that the fall highweight back then was a prestigious race, not like now where people don't pay any attention to it anymore. Back then, I mean, look at the horses that ran in the fall highway. You know, I remember when Taui won back-to-back fall highways. I mean, all the top sprinters ran in the fall highway. And, that's back when they were giving horses 140 pounds, 138 pounds. I think she carried like 136, 134, something like that. I mean, she carried a lot.
134.
134, okay. She was tough. She was a good filly. And the fact that she could run well going two turns like that, I mean, when she ran against Kamalati Laurie, I mean, that was a close finish. It was like, a half a length, three quarters, something like that. It was, I know it was less than a length, but she battled her all the way to the wire. It's going a mile and eighth against, at the time, the best filly in the country, coming off of sprints. I mean, so she was, she was terrific. That was the years, by the way, when Leroy Jolly totally dominated the sport and the Firestones. I mean, they just had every year they had terrific horses between Genuine Risk and Honest Pleasure. And I mean, there was so many good horses. Optimistic Gal. I mean, I can make a whole big list
Optimistic,
of horses. I mean,
yeah.
Year after year they had these terrific horses.
Well, Steve, on that topic to some degree, and before we talk about the LeCompte on Saturday, as well as you kicking off Derby Dozen, your Judmont and Prince Khalid thoughts?
Obviously not many people met him. He was a very very quiet person, and was not in public a lot. But boy, the empire that he built, and he did it all on his own. I mean, he picked out all the breeding. Everything went through him. He was not like one of these owners that said, hired somebody and picked out breeding and let me know what happens. He did all the breeding. All these families that they have are all his families. If somebody had an idea to what mare to breed to what stallion, it would have to go through him. But that's why if you look at the Judmont, the families go back years and years. And the amazing thing about him is that people are real. I guess they do realize it, but at the time, I guess a lot of people didn't think about it. But for here, you have a Saudi Arabian prince, and his top trainer is a Jew from Brooklyn. I mean, if that's not a sign of what the world should be like, I've never seen it. I mean, it was so totally different. He's reserved, a royalty, Saudi Arabian. And here you got this brash Jewish kid from Brooklyn, and they got along swimmingly. I mean, their success that they had together. I mean, you know, Bobby Frankel just built that empire for him here. And for years and years, the amount of horses and the families that they built with those unbelievable broodmares, the fillies that Bobby Frankel trained that became, you know, tremendous broodmares like Toussaint and all these, and the horses that he had here. And I tell you, Bobby Frankel was convinced. He was totally convinced when Empire Maker was a yearling. He went to the farm to see him, and he came back, and he told me. I was in the shed row. He had just come back from Kentucky to Judmont. And he says, and his exact words, he says, I'm going to be the first Triple Crown winner. Since affirmed, he was convinced that he was going to break that string with Empire Maker. He called him a Triple Crown winner,
yep.
And he probably yep. would have won the Triple Crown if he didn't get hurt the week before the Derby and never trained for the race. But that horse was meant for greatness. You know, he turned out to be a terrific stallion too, but. It's amazing, you know. Here he decides to, to have a California campaign, and he specifically wants to run the classics. So, who does he wind up with? Right off the bat, the first horse he gets is Arrogate. I mean, he just had a way with getting these horses, and he was just amazing. It was good. He got at least a chance, you know, before he died, to see one of the great. You know, one of the great fillies of all time run in Europe.
Yeah, and of course the whole, you know, yesterday with Nick Gluck, particularly, and we talked about, you know, the way they identified Frankel and you know, went ahead. The Khalid wanted a, you know, he wanted a special horse to name after Bobby, and how could it have worked out any better? It's just,
bizarre. I mean, he picked a horse. It's amazing because when I wrote about Frankel, the first thing I said about him, and I didn't want to sound, you know, like I was being a homer or anything. When I said Frankel was an American horse let loose on a European racetrack. He didn't run like a European. He ran like an American horse. He was like a Seattle Slough type of horse. He would just blow out there and just run the horses off their feet. You know, he'd run the 2,000 guineas. He'd have like a 10-length lead in the middle of the race. You never see that in Europe. And he never came back. He just kept going. So, I mean, if you look at the kind of horse that Frankel was, he couldn't have picked a better person to name him after, than Bobby Frankel.
No, it's an amazing the legacy. Yesterday I had conversations with Lenny, with Sid on the breeding side, and with Nick Luck, and with each of them, you could literally bring up, you know, 10 different Judmont stars, and not duplicate. In the course of discussing them. I can't remember which of the three conversations, but it was with Nick Luck. We got to the end of a half an hour with Nick, and we hadn't mentioned a navel.
Oh, really? All right. I guess you were working front to front.
It's amazing. And then, you know, then when you talk about Bobby's horses, I mean, I think people's minds are geared toward, the ones that are more contemporary. But when you start going through those, you know, those early, you know, aught horses that Bobby had. I mean, we played Intercontinentals Breeders' Cup, mm-hmm. But then, you know, Sightseek and Banks Hill, and you know, there's just all the ones from that era, that are kind of not that they're forgotten by any means, but they just. There were so many.
That's why they all seem like the same horse because they all basically all most of them had the same running style except they were like a filly like Intercontinental or so, but they all had this tremendous stretch kick, and Bobby had a way with those fillies. That Toussaint was a nutcase, and she was a tremendous a filly despite that, but Bobby got along great with them. But I would love. So we've gone back to the beginning to see how the two of them got together. I mean, I can't picture Bobby meeting him for the first time and him saying, "Oh, you want to be my trainer?" And yeah, you know, if you knew Bobby, he was like completely the opposite of what you think of the Prince. I mean, it's just incredible.
Well, it was. I think it was actually Lenny that that referenced the backstory that the Prince found him after doing essentially a computer analysis of trainer statistics.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. He did it there. I'm not saying how he got to him. I'm just trying to. The first time they ever met each other. I mean, it's just like there was so. Once he met him, he said, "That's the guy. That's the guy I'm going to have my trainer with. Or who the heck is this? Who the heck is this guy?" I mean, he was just so totally opposite. But again, it shows you what you could do. Two people from totally different cultures. You know, Jewish and Arab, how people can get along together. But you talk about racing making strange bedfellows.
No doubt. And I can remember a conversation at the barbecue when Bobby would come sit and eat. And he was more proud of that than he used to say. You know, he would say, "Could you imagine, just like your reference, you know, the..."
Oh, he always said that.
Jewish kid from Brooklyn. Yeah.
Can you imagine, the association that we have and the diversity of our backgrounds and who we are and everything? You know, it's just amazing. But hopefully it looks like the kids will the children, are going to, keep it going, cuz I'd hate to lose. I mean, it's so recognizable. You know, you would hate to see it disappear.
I said the same thing, and Nick, Nick had spoken to John Gosden yesterday morning and on Nick's daily show, and that was nice news that because there wasn't an obvious it's not like we've seen or have had an indication that there was an heir apparent. In that regard. So that is good news. Steve, we got tons to do, and I still got to get Seth in here. We'll bring Rich Eng in for Friday like we did last week too, and Rich do some Santa Anita.
Bump Rich Eng. I hate doing that.
Because of yesterday's programming, I actually didn't get to Seth, so I want to get to Seth today, and then last week actually it was good, Rich, on Friday to do some he did some Friday handicapping, so that was fine.
I'm on the Derby trail.
I was going to say, give everybody you sent that email the other day, and let everybody know where to find Derby doings.
Yes, it's going to be. It'll be on Mondays instead of Tuesdays. Trying to get an early jump on it, except for the second week because I'll be in Connecticut. So it'll probably be by the time we get back on Monday, it'll probably be for Tuesday. But every other week, it'll be on Monday. Secretariat.com, and it's going to be the same as Derby Dozen, except that it'll be the Derby rankings, and we're not limited. I'm not limited to 12 horses. I can put as many as I want. I'll probably start with 12 or 15, and then, as we go on, I'll continue. Same knocking on the door and open for comments. Anybody have an opinion or want to call me a jerk, for not having their horse on there? In fact, looking at the amount of horses this year, and how wide open it is and everything, and how tough it is to try and come up with 15 when there's so many out there. I want to let everybody know now, here's what you do. I'm going to do something different this year. If you have a favorite Derby horse and you want him listed on the rankings in the top 12 or top 15, I want you to send me the name of the horse with a $20 bill. And I guarantee you, I'll put it on your list. that's my tribute to Soupy Sales.
Go to your parents' wallet.
That story, by the way, but
Sure they do.
So he said, it was a, you know, brilliant, had a kid show. One of the things he had, he said, all you boys and girls, I want you to do something for me. He says, tonight, when your mommy and daddy are sleeping, I want you to go into their bedroom, be very quiet. I want you to open up your daddy's wallet and take out $1 bill. And I want you to take it, and I want you to mail it to me at this address. And he got so many there that they suspended him. I mean, he got suspended from television for like a year or so. So that's my tribute to Soupy Sales, by the way. If you want your horse on the Derby Dozen, just send me the name of the horse and a $20 bill, and he is, and I will put him on there.
There you go. Well, speaking of some early. Potential inclusions. Let's talk about that LeCompte. Give everybody your early view here. One of the nice things that happens in Louisiana are these early draws, and so you get a chance to really look at the fields for days in advance.
Well, there's one horse on there that I have already slated to have in my on the rankings. I'll see how he does because everything I've seen about the horse, he just looks like the consummate pro. Want to see him go two turns, and that's just in fact, it's a Judmond horse, Mandelound, who I watched both of his races at Keeneland and Churchill very, very closely, and he just did everything the right way. He's got a great eye to him. He just looks like he can be something really special, and he's one of like 50 Into Mischiefs. I can't get rid of these Into Mischiefs. Like, they're plaguing me. I mean, they're all over. Every time a horse wins brilliantly or does something, I look up, of course, Into Mischief. What else is new? Now, this is an Into Mischief out of an Empire Maker mare. So, you know, you've got Empire Maker in there. But I was very high in this horse, and this will be a big test for him. If he runs a big race here, there's probably a good chance that he'll be in the top 12 or 15, whatever I do. But there are some really nice horses in here. Godolphin's got a horse. Mike Stidham has a horse, Proxy, in here. And the key to this horse, okay, his last two starts, he won both races. But his jockey, his past jockey, he's got a new jockey now, who I don't even know, Mitchell Morrill, do you know that jockey? I'm not familiar with him.
Steve, it looks like we've lost.
But Angel Suarez, who rode him in his last two races.
Steve, it looks like we've lost connection with Steve.
Refused to hand ride this horse. Every time he whipped his horse, the horse would duck out, duck in, shy from the whip. Last race, he switched leads, jumped to his left lead, and he still won anyway. And he's really a nice horse. So if this horse, if Morrill can ride this horse and hand ride him and not whip him, because he's a good horse. He came from way back in his first start, and he won wire to wire in his next two starts. So I'm really anxious to see this horse. He's got an excellent pedigree, and I'm also looking at him. If he can run cleanly and not be as green, and just get the type of hand ride that he needs, he could be something else. I've been looking at Arabian Prince, the West Point horse. I thought he's run really well. Ran third last time out in the Kentucky Jockey Club against Keep Me In Mind, who I think is one of the top. In fact, the second horse, too, Smiley Sabatka. I think both of those are really, really good horses. And I'm also curious to see how Midnight Bourbon does. Midnight Bourbon, you know, looked like a really, really good horse, especially when he ran a big race in the Iroquois. And he was well, well beaten third in the Champagne. But I still think he's a really nice horse. And I'm curious to see how he makes the transition from 2 to 3. So he's a really good horse. Norm Cassie has this horse, Beep Beep, who's got entered in an allowance race on the same card. So we'll see what he does with him. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting horses in this race that look like they could be decent horses. Santa Cruz is coming off a nice win at Churchill. So I'm curious. You know, that's why I've got to hold up now. I can't really complete my list until I see what happens on Saturday. Because if somebody wins this race impressively, they're definitely going to go on. Because I think this is one of the better LeCompte fields with some really good horses, good trainers, you know, top owners. So I'm really looking forward to this race. gun horse that was originally supposed to go in here, who I think, who I mentioned to you last time, who I'm really, really high on, the Senor Buscador, they decided to pass on this race and wait for the Risen Star, which is probably a good idea. But I just want to see what happens here. Like I said, the number one horse is Mandalone. I want to see if he runs, if he wins this race, runs a big race. He's got to move. He's got to move way up on my list. But again, all these other horses I mentioned to you too, keeping a very close eye on. By the way, I'm at a disadvantage this year because the laptop that's hooked up to my printer finally died after like 20 something years of it. The screen just went black. You know, I can't get the screen to come on. It starts to come on, then it goes black. So I think the screen blew out or something. So I'm not sure if this my other laptop will hook up to my printer or not. So I can't print out Best Performances. I've got to do everything off the off my other laptop.
Well, that's no fun.
No, I'm so, you know, listen, I'm so used to doing it. Like, especially like, you know, next week when the next Future Wager comes out, you know, I always like to have the print out the past performances of that.
Yeah, of course.
My number one bathroom material, you know, looking at the Future Wager past performances. So I'll have to say, I'll have to check it. And hopefully this other laptop will automatically hook up to my my printer, okay? Because if it doesn't, I have no idea how to line it up or how to hook it up or so, but I'll have to check that out. But I am at a disadvantage. I knew one of these days that laptop would die. I've had it for so long. I don't know if it's fixable or not, but I think once that screen blows...
Sometimes actually.
I might bring it into my computer place.
Let them try.
See if they can somehow get it back on. It starts to come on. It says Dell, and then it starts to come on afterwards, and then it just goes black. You know what I mean? And it just like you can hear, like whenever I start it, the motor comes on. You can hear the motor, the fan going, and then you know it goes, and then it just dies down. And when it does, the screen goes black. So I'll check it out. You know, I'm not gonna bury it until I know it's officially dead.
Well, this is a nice group, and there's also a nice set of maiden races to consider as well. Anybody in there that caught your eye?
The two maiden races are both 6 furlongs.
Right.
So, you know, any horse now breaking their maiden at 6 furlongs in mid-January, you know, to me they're at a disadvantage. But there was a mile and a 16th, or a mile, I think it's a mile and a 16th.
Yeah,
a
mile and
a
16th. Yeah,
that the allowance.
Well, no, there's also, there's also the sixth race is a mile and a 16th maiden.
Is there a 6 mile and 16th maiden race?
Yeah, the one, because we had Mark Cassie the other day, and we talked about Scarlet Fusion, for instance, the Scarlet Tango. And
that's the race I'm talking about.
That's a maiden special. Yeah.
Oh, it's a maiden. Oh, okay. Yeah, right. What am I talking about? Yeah, yeah, Scarlet Fusion, by the way, his last start, I was very impressed with that horse. He ran a very, very game race. He was pressing the pace the whole way, and it was under a lot of pressure. And even though, you know, it was set up for a comfy hind horse, he never quit. He was right there at the 16th pole, and he kept trying to come back the whole last eighth of a mile. And I was very impressed with him. So I'm really curious to see how Scarlet Fusion does. He's a very game horse.
It's funny, by the way, that this comes up because there's a horse, I think, tomorrow. I mentioned at the start of the show, I gave everybody an update. I connected with Gary Shearer this morning, and there's a filly maiden special. That I discussed, and I think, was it in this race or was it somewhere else from the weekend? There, Scarlet Tango, this Scarlet Fusion is a sibling of Terra's Tango. And Tara's Tango has, I think, her first foal that is running this weekend. And I'm here. It's funny that seeing Scarlet Fusion again. I just saw this. There's something. There's some connect. Oh, let me look at this because I've got to find.
If anybody is watching all the races tomorrow, and actually LeComp can be shown on the Naira show.
Yes, on the Naira show.
But the fairgrounds got a state. They have a 6 furlong maiden race, then a mile and a 16th maiden race, and then a mile and a 16th allowance race, and then the LeComp. So it's a big day for 3-year-olds down there. So keep an eye on all four of those races.
Here it is. On Saturday in the 4th at Gulfstream, Bill Mott and Godolphin send the Terra's Tango colt by Medaglia d'Oro, Alexander Valley. So kind of interesting. You've got the Scarlet Tango connection. This is like a nephew. Scarlet Fusion and Alexander Valley closely related. Saturday.
Yeah, this is a great time of the year. Once you start getting mid-January, early February, before you completely eliminate all the maiden winners that you figure they're just too far behind, but you still got to look at them all. Even the 6 furlong races, Justify showed that. Nobody ever heard of Justify at this time, so. You gotta watch all of these races. You just never know what's gonna pop up. That's why it's exciting. I love looking at the maiden and allowance races because you try and get in on the bottom floor. You want to see if you can find a really really good horse. I told you last year about this time, a very prominent owner asked me to look for a horse that he could buy.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggested this horse, Caracaro, who had just broken his maiden, who I just absolutely loved everything about him. And as it turns out, he didn't buy him. I don't think he liked his speed figures or so. But the horse got hurt, comes back and runs second in the Peter Pan and second in the Trappers, and then got hurt again, unfortunately. But I think he would have been a really really good horse. So I feel good about that. But it's just fun looking for these horses, and trying to find a horse coming, just starting out, get in on the bottom floor in the horse and try and spot a potential star early on.
No doubt. And, of course, the Phillies also at Fairgrounds on Saturday.
Yeah, getting Silver Bullet, Silver Bullet Day. Good race, too.
Okay, yep. Super Sensational draws down inside for Mrs. Weber and Cassie. And we went through a lot of stuff with Mark the other day. There's a lot of nice connections. Judmont actually sends Sunpath in that race. So we'll see. Let me see if that's the first Judmont horse that's going to run in North America since the passing. I'm going to guess it is, but maybe not. Let's see if there was one yesterday or today.
If not, then it'll be Mandelown in the LeCompte.
There's actually on Friday. Friday will be the first obligatory.
Okay. Obligatory. Steve, I'll give you another Judmont horse to watch. A maiden winner who is very very impressive. I think he's also another intermission. A horse called Prate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He's a gray horse. He was very very impressive in his first start, and I liked a lot of what I saw about that horse. So Judmont, they got Prate, they got Mandelown, and it would be something if they won their first Derby this year. But both these horses look like really, really good horses.
This is a filly of Judmont's for Bill Mott, a Curland filly out of Uno Duo, the Macho Uno mare, obligatory, and goes in the fourth race tomorrow at Aqueduct, making a second career start, was fourth at Belmont in her debut. So that'll be the first Judmont runner. And then they've also, you mentioned Mandaloon, and there's one more actually that runs on Saturday in a maiden race. Folsom goes in the seventh on the grass. That's the grass race. This will be for Brad Cox, an Into Mischief out of Flourish. So four Judmont runners.
Into Mischief's coming from, my goodness.
That's unbelievable. It's like
it's one after another.
Factory. When you cover 215 mares, they got to turn up somewhere.
They all can run. I mean, every one of them. Every time I watch a race, I say, oh, my God, that horse looks great. I look at pedigree. Into Mischief. What else is new? And what do you do with him? I got burned last year by him, you know, with Authentic. And now I can't just discard them, you know, saying, oh, Into Mischief, you know, they can't go a mile and a quarter. Well, surprise. Every single one of them now.
Well, Steve, should be a fun day. And even though there's not a lot of graded stake action away from fairgrounds, there is plenty of maidens and plenty of stakes around the country. So a lot of three-year-olds swinging into action too, and it's starting to get good.
Derby time.
There you go.
Secretariat.com. Saturday and May Derby.
Well. We hope so.
We hope so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, they won't move it this year. They might not have anybody there again, but...
Exactly.
But they're not moving it this year.
No, I agree. I was going to let you go. Well, actually, I will. I'll let you go, and we'll do some recapping, and we'll have the Pegasus card to talk about next week as well, although that they're falling by the wayside.
I know.
At a steady clip.
The horses that aren't running.
Yeah, I know. But hey, you that's going to happen. There's nothing you can do to stop that.
$3 million race. So I mean, they're going to get. somebody will win it.
You know, and then the following week, you know, you got the Holy Bull follows up and more. The Swale, the Lewis, the Bob Lewis is on the 30th, too. So it's going to start rolling out here in a hurry.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Steve, this was a fun hour. I'm glad we brought you in on Tony, and you and I will talk potential horses to float as Hall of Fame considerations.
Yes, it'll be off air. To have your voice on there.
I'm looking forward to it. We're going to take a break, last of the morning, and we're looking for Seth. But if not Seth, we'll get to Rich Eng. Back after this at the races.
The latest racing news. It's at the races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back, and we got about 10 minutes to spend. Rich Ang, though, is going to join us now because it turns out that Seth is in the car, and you know Seth is very careful. So he's not going to he's on the North Way, apparently. I'm not sure where he's headed, but we'll table Seth Merrow. Rich, I was almost going to come back with you again on another Friday visit, but we'll swing into action with you right now. Good morning.
Oh, that's all right. I can be your designated hitter. You need me, you call me.
I appreciate it. I there's big news, sad news out of Vegas. I see that Siegfried died.
Yeah, that was really something. One of the few things I was not able to see when Sandy and I first moved to Las Vegas was I was never able to attend a Siegfried and Roy show, which I guess a lot of people considered one of the key entertainment venues, that and maybe seeing Wayne Newton back in his time. But the time passes, and it's rest in peace.
Well, in the meantime, in Vegas, I'm sure there's plenty of excitement because the Knights are back in action.
Yeah, it's fun to have no fans in the stands yet, though. But at least we get the hockey and on television again, and can get to watch that. And we had fun with the national championship game on Monday. That was always a big betting game, Alabama and Ohio State. So there's always a lot of things to bet on here in town. That's for sure.
Well, and it's pretty amazing when you reference. It makes me think when you reference your origins and coming to Las Vegas. I mean, you couldn't have imagined, Rich, as long as you've been there now, that there'd be professional sports franchises in that town.
Well, it was kind of fun. I mean, I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, and actually had the chance to see hockey games. I saw the Hartford Whalers and the New York Islanders and the New York Rangers, and then to come out here and have a National Hockey League team, expansion team, the Vegas Golden Knights, it was kind of fun. And then, the first year was so phenomenal 3 years ago when here in an expansion team, making the Stanley Cup Finals and
playing
the Washington Capitals. I mean, that's unheard of on any level of professional sports. But, they won our hearts for sure.
Well, they start the season tonight. And actually, they do start at home, Anaheim in town. And so there's lots of ties between the racing community and hockey. I mean, everybody – you got Jay Privman, Go Kings Go. You got the Rangers and Grenig, and there's no shortage. And then for those that are fans of Dink, Alan Dinkinson, he's got his Dink Fund that raises charity money, and hockey is his. He's been keyed up waiting for the hockey season. So then you got Eddie Olczyk and Denny Savard. And I mean, there's countless ties between. And if I don't mention Eric Johnson, he's going to get mad at me. So, there's no shortage of ties between the and Tony Black just texted me. He's right. Jerry Cheevers, who owned and had a couple of nice horses in his day as an owner. So yeah, hockey and horses go together nicely. And Rich, I started the morning with some news. Nice little tidbit yesterday, that simulcast contract adjustment that TVG and Stronach Group has authored, for that should really bolster things when it comes to, the purse accounts, the daily overnight purses. That was an upbeat piece of news yesterday.
Yeah, that was fantastic news, to be able to work that agreement out. Because, what happens sometimes with racetracks is when they try to increase purse money, they end up increasing the takeout, And so, in essence, the it's we, the horse players, who pay for that purse increase. But this one seemed to be, you know, not affecting us in our horse players' pockets, so to speak. But there's, you know, plenty of cash to go around. And during this pandemic, you know, so much of the wagering now has shifted. You know,
exactly.
Places, there's no one on track. They're doing it at home. And so that pool has grown just huge, especially in 2020 and now into 2021.
Well, in terms of growing some pools, let's grow the pools ourselves. What are we looking at today?
Well, with Aqueduct closed on Thursdays, I you know, Santa Anita has not been racing, so I was
right.
doing Aqueduct cards, but they don't have one today, so I did the Gulfstream Park Pick 6, and I'd be willing to give a couple of horses that I
sure.
like on the Gulfstream card. The first one will come in race number 5. It's kind of a nondescript maiden claiming race, but I thought a horse that ran pretty well in her debut in race 5, number 3, Gaga Olala, if I say that correctly. But I don't know the trainer, Anna Varsi, but this horse outran the 35-1 odds and ran a good second, and I think is live at 5-1, so that's my first pick. My second pick will come in race number 10, 12,500 claiming race, 5.5 furlongs. Let's go to the number 6, Sense a Million, 7-2 in the morning line. This horse actually taking a class drop, even though the same price tag of 12,500 as she ran at last time, but it's restricted this time for non-winners of 3 races lifetime, so it is a class drop. So that'll be my second pick, and last week I did go 1 out of 2, and I think the winner I gave out paid like $9 and something
yep.
cents, so, you know, that's a profit.
Well done. So let me recap, because I just printed out the quick sheet. The 3 horse, Gaga Olala,
yeah.
With Christian Torres aboard in the 5th, and the other one.
The other one in race number 10. Let's go with the 6, Sense a Million. Alfredo Velasquez claimed his horse recently, but dropping in class to a restricted 12.5.
There we go. The 6, 7-2, Sense a Million, and Edgar Zayas is aboard. There's just looking up and down the card. 10 race card today, and kind of a.
I do know, Steve. I guess they've got some weather there, so I believe a lot of the early grass races are off already. So I know in the pick 6, I know the 6th race is on the main track. Some of the earlier grass races are too.
Well, I have not. I played last Saturday. I did some actually one of the first cards I really looked at Gulfstream seriously. And we're going to be, you know, fairgrounds going to be impossible not to be the focus on Saturday. Sam Houston for us today, and I'll write that up as soon as I wrap up with Rich. And we talked earlier with Chris Griffin and the first of their Space City Pick 6s. And, you know, Rich, I don't know, you know, if you've had a chance to consider, not to handicap it, but just there's an interesting consideration that you mentioned the Gulfstream Pick 6. Well, this new Space City Pick 6 with a 50-cent increment, I'm anxious even for my own purposes when I build the ticket, and you know, usually my budget for big multis is about $72 is you know, kind of where I focus, and so I'm anxious to see, you know, how that shakes out. You know, obviously that'd be 144 combinations, so I'm eager to play this, and it's a very attractive proposition with a 12%. To have a pick 6 like this with a 12% takeout is kind of irresistible.
Yeah, you know, I do not mind experimentation, try to find the right, you know, to kind
exactly.
of tweak with it a little bit and find the right thing that fits your marketplace. I know Naira has did tweak their pick 6, and they've had some success with it, so I don't mind the experimentation.
Well, I think we've got. I think you're going to have to experiment with that race, that 5th race, because our friend Tom Herman is reporting that the 3 has scratched.
we'll double up the bet in reach 10 then.
There you go. You're going to get reach deeper for cents a million, the 6th in the 10th race. Rich, good luck this weekend. Of course, Rich's analysis for Southern California, and it is a holiday Monday coming up, of course, MLK Day. So lots of opportunity. Santa Anita's action with Rich. RaceDayLasVegas.com. Rich Eng for Pro Pick. Rich, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Al. Thanks, Steve. Good luck, everybody.
You got it. Our man, Rich Eng, everybody. Capping a fast, another full morning. Rich Eng, Steve Haskin, Tony Black, plus a little Steve Haskin, Tony Black together, which was a lot of fun, and Chris Griffin from SHRP. I'll write that up right now. I'm eager to do. I'm looking forward to this. It starts at 6:56 Eastern. So, good. It's kind of a good niche, I think. Sam Houston with this pick six. Weekend preview tomorrow. Lots of Marcus Hirsch. We'll have an extensive Marcus Hirsch visit when we look at the fairgrounds action. Nick Tamaro as well. Scully Hammer from Oaklawn. They're taking entries tomorrow as they get ready to go. Should be great. All right, buddy. Talk to you tomorrow at the races, SiriusXM.
With Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.